These old carriages are quite hard to get into, surprising really, given they were made for much shorter people than ourselves. There we are. Now, I've asked you to join me on this little jaunt because I can't think of any more appropriate setting for some of the stories I've turned up in my researches. It's an old mountain path, but old Hilliard will guide us over it safely. Won't you, Mr. Hilliard? Good man. He never speaks. Very well, off we go. Now, it's a little rocky at first, but at least we're well cushioned with this fine Victorian upholstery. Horsehair, I imagine. We'll take one turn up the mountain path and then double back. Enjoy the scenery while we share a few more hair-raising tales from Irish history. Not that we'll see much through this fog. Can you make out that ruin on the hilltop? It's an old Victorian folly, or what's left of it. Not that impressive, some architect's hurried joke. But there's another ruin on another hilltop far away in County Limerick, which has a much more interesting history, and need I say, a much more horrifying one. What's left of Shannid Castle still stands atop a mound in Shanagolden, County Limerick. The nearest modern town is Newcastle West, but in its day, Shannid Castle was a reference point all of its own, commanding the mountain pass between Limerick and Kerry and visible to half the province. Its day was a long time ago. A castle has stood on that lonely spot for probably 1,000 years. It was the first fortified home of one of the most storied families in Ireland, the Fitzgeralds. They founded a dynasty which attained unimaginable wealth and power across the centuries, but they never forgot where it all began. The family motto would always remain Shannid Abu. The Fitzgeralds were perpetually at war with another noble family, the Butlers. Sometimes they took opposite sides in wider conflicts, sometimes they just fought each other for the hell of it. During one of these wars, the Butlers forced the Fitzgerald back to their last remaining stronghold, Shannid Castle. In the confusion, as the Butlers tried to force the siege, the great leader of the Fitzgeralds, the Earl of Desmond, managed to slip out through the melee and the smoke and the chaos, along with his wife, the Countess of Desmond. He grabbed a loose horse, leapt upon it, and dragged the Countess up behind him. Setting off at a gallop through the raging battle, he had almost made it clear when he was recognized by one of the Butler's men. The soldier loaded his crossbow, took careful aim, and as the Earl's horse flew towards him, he released the bolt. The shot whizzed past the Earl's shoulder, but buried itself deep in the body of the Countess. With the Countess bleeding pitifully behind him as he clung to her, the Earl at last made it to the sanctuary of the old abbey. He pleaded with the prioress and her sister nuns to save the Countess's life, but there was, they said, nothing they could do. The wound was fatal, and the Countess already dead. She was buried with whatever ceremony they could muster under the altar in the chapel, and the Earl set out for Askeaton, where he would be safe. Soon after, the haunting began. Noises in the night, a white, ghostly figure seen throughout the abbey, so often and so horrifying in its aspect that the work of the abbey came to a standstill. The nuns were quite convinced that the revenant was none other than the Countess of Desmond. And what else was there to do but to pull up the flagstones, open the tomb, remove her corpse, and try somehow to give her spirit some kind of peace? Nothing could have prepared those poor nuns for the sight they saw when they rolled back the stone. The Countess's corpse was there, all right. Not lying peacefully in repose as they had left her, but grotesquely bent and twisted, with a wild expression frozen on her face. The bones of her fingers worn away to stubs. The appalling truth soon dawned on the horrified sisters. Her crossbow wound had not, in fact, killed the Countess. The nuns' inexpert hands had not felt the faint pulse that still lingered as they laid her in her tomb. They had buried the woman, alive. She had died of shock and frenzy, desperately trying to escape from her premature tomb. A tomb she escaped only after death, to haunt those who had, with ministering hands, sent her unwittingly to her doom. Like Shannid Castle, the ruins of that old nunnery still stand near Shanagolden. It is said that on still nights, when the cows have ceased their grazing and when all else is silence, the Countess's screams can still be heard, echoing through the night. Incidentally, those ruins are also known as the Black Hag's Cell, but that's another legend altogether, and the truth has more to do with religious bigotry than with the supernatural. Now, speaking of hills, there's another hill 150 miles from Shanagolden in Dublin City that I want to tell you about. A hill with a most descriptive and evocative name. It's called Misery Hill. And how it got that name, well, that's the story in a nutshell. Once upon a time, Misery Hill was a heavily industrial area, famed for its huge gasometer, which dominated the skyline over Sir John Rogerson's Quay for miles around. And where did it get the name Misery Hill? Well, some say from its association with unfortunate victims of leprosy, but more than likely it's because in times past, before the coming of industry, before the coming of the factories and the warehouses, Misery Hill was the site of a gallows where many wretched convicts ended their miserable lives. One of those wretches, hanged for a trifling offence of which he was in any case entirely innocent, was the young sailor named Michael Preston, who gasped his last breath on Misery Hill sometime in the mid-18th century. In keeping with the grim practice of the time, his body was left to dangle and putrefy for weeks on end. Such was the enlightened ruler's contempt for the flesh of the downtrodden. Michael had been engaged to marry a beautiful young girl from the locality, and every night she would come from her little cottage to behold this appalling vista of her intended's corpse swinging from the gallows in a reverie of horror. When the authorities finally, in a small act of mercy, cut the corpse down, well, the shock and the grief must have hit her all at once, for she ran away and drowned herself in the Liffey. She mustn't ever have found Michael in the afterlife, because for decades, decades afterwards, many is the local docker and sailor told of the young girl who approached them in the dead of night on Misery Hill and asked, in a pleading voice, why did they hang Michael Preston? One hopes that somewhere, somehow, down the years and the decades and the centuries, she finally got an answer which gave her peace. Misery Hill has come to be associated with a much more modern evil in recent years, one which well befits its name, but that circus has subsequently moved on. Not sure why we've stopped. I say, Hilliard. Hilliard. Excuse me a moment, I'll go up and check on him. Shan't be a moment. Only me. Not sure where Hilliard's got himself to. Gone for a smoke, perhaps. Don't suppose you can drive a coach? No, of course not. Anyway, we can hardly leave him behind. I'm sure he'll be back in a moment. Do you want a nip of something? In the meantime, I think we've spoken before about the numerous hauntings which have been reported in police barracks and Garda stations throughout Irish history. The spectres such as the Old Woman of Talla, which have been encountered by so many coppers on their beat. Of all the police forces that have operated in, or perhaps I should say operated on Ireland, the Royal Irish Constabulary, the old colonial militia, seems to have been particularly spirit-tormented. In fact, one RIC man, a certain Daniel McGillicuddy of Queen's County, now County Leash, wrote to the Irish Independent in 1905 to report not one, not two, but three encounters with ghosts that he had experienced throughout his career. On the first occasion, sometime in the late 19th century, McGillicuddy happened to be in a household which had tragically lost a child. Indeed, he'd been at the child's funeral just 3 days earlier. On this occasion, he wandered into the room where the child had been waked and saw the self-same child sleeping peacefully in the bed with a beatific smile on its face. This happened in broad daylight, and McGillicuddy raced from the room in shock and fear, returning with several members of the bereaved household, only to find the child had vanished. Had he simply imagined the whole scene? Possibly. Except for the clear indentation of a child's head on the pillow. McGillicuddy had another chilling experience in 1904 when he and a companion passed by a churchyard not long before midnight on a bright moonlit night. McGillicuddy spotted three men, ordinary country boys, he said, sitting on a small hill beside the churchyard and bade them good night. "Who are you saying good night to?" his companion asked. Turning to gesture towards the three men, McGillicuddy saw them disappear before his eyes. His companion saw nothing. Reflecting on the experience, McGillicuddy said the three men looked deathly pale and emaciated, perhaps victims of the Great Famine, come to watch over a churchyard filled with their friends and neighbours, whose lives had also been cruelly cut short. But our paranormally sensitive Bobby was not finished yet, for just a few months later he brushed up against the Great Veil once more. While walking a quiet country road known for apparitions of a long-deceased local woman clad in black, McGillicuddy saw, well, what else but a woman clad in black, wearing a shawl, looking as solid and natural as you or I. Except for two things. The rush of cold air felt by McGillicuddy and his companion as the woman passed by. And the rather more disquieting fact that upon reaching a certain house, the house in which the deceased lady once lived, the woman passed through the door without opening it. A vision, incidentally, that McGillicuddy insists his companion saw too. Well, it may simply have been that the RIC attracted particularly credulous recruits. Let's not forget that a co-author of the valuable but profoundly misnamed True Irish Ghost Stories was a detective inspector, Henry Lancelot Neligan. But in fact, every police force throughout Irish history was prone to witnessing these supernatural, though not extra-legal, phenomena. Not all such visitations were unwelcome. among a later generation of policemen, the Garda Síochána of the Irish Free State, a tale was told, and apparently attested by many, of the spectre of the Phoenix Park. At this time, members of the Gardaí were assigned to protect the Governor General, a colonial hangover, at the Grand Viceregal Lodge in the Phoenix Park, which today hosts the President of Ireland. Falling asleep on guard duty was a serious disciplinary offence, for which many's the sleepy sentry lost his job, and woe betide to the Garda who took refuge in the sentry box, except in the most extreme weather. He would find himself dragged out of the box by an inspection party and potentially up on a charge. The loneliest post of all was the sentry box on the back road, a tree-lined approach to the lodge where sunlight never penetrated and where the nights were dark and silent. The perfect place for the unwary sentry to doze off and land himself in hot water. Except that never happened on the back road, because sentries who did doze off would inevitably find themselves awakened by several loud knocks on the sentry box. After which, once he'd rubbed the sleep from his eyes and emerged from the sentry box, the sentry would be suitably alert to impress the inspector, who invariably arrived within moments of the knocking. This mysterious entity who gave this warning came to be known as the policeman's friend, and saved the skin, or at least the eardrums, of countless Gardaí over the years. Ah, we're off again. Good old Hilliard must have finished his smoke, turning around for the homeward stretch, but we've plenty of time for a couple more tales. Our next tale, which should see us most of the way home, isn't that right, Hilliard? Suit yourself. Is another cautionary tale, another warning about being careful what you wish for. It's the story of how a single seance ruined several lives. And it's a story of how Paganini, the devil's violinist, made an appearance in Dublin's High Court almost a century ago, in October of 1931. By 1931, the Irish Hospital Sweepstakes was one of the most popular and lucrative lotteries in the world. It was a kind of double lottery. You bought a ticket to enter the main draw, and then the lucky handful whose tickets were drawn would be randomly assigned a horse in a major race, and if that horse finished first, second or third, you got a certain share of the enormous jackpot. This was a time before fully legalized gambling in many countries, and so the sweepstakes became immensely popular throughout the world, particularly on the black market in the United States and Britain. Incidentally, a lot of the darkest deeds involved in the hospital sweepstakes and its notorious organizer, Joe McGrath, had nothing to do with ghosts or ghouls or spirits or seances. They were very earthly horrors, but they're beyond the scope of this story. The winner of the 1931 sweepstakes would be decided by the outcome of the English Grand National at Aintree, and so many tickets were sold all over the world that the jackpot reached unimaginable heights. The winning ticket would be worth over 383,000 Irish pounds to its holder. That's tens upon tens of millions in today's money, whichever way you slice it. That year's Grand National seemed to be a cursed affair. Several horses were killed during the race, and several jockeys were seriously injured. It was won by a horse named Graykle, at odds of 100-6. And the man who held that ticket was a London Italian called Emilio Scala. Now, Scala had already sold a share of his ticket to a bookie, but he was still left with almost £100,000 clear profit. That was until the ghost of Rasputin entered the story. Sunday, February 8th, 1931. Behind an anonymous red brick facade in Arkley Crescent, Walthamstow, the dead are talking. A small group of Italians, including Mr. Scala, have gathered at the home of Matteo Constantino, a London hairdresser, to commune with the spirits. As they hold hands around the three-legged table, Mr. Scala shuts his eyes fast in deep concentration. The spirit they've conjured, or seem to have conjured, is no dearly departed aunt or uncle. This is not an ordinary ghost. It is the spirit of Rasputin, the mad monk, the most hated and feared man in the Russian Empire besides the Tsar himself. Diabolical in life, he seems to be omniscient in death. And the tension in the darkened room is palpable. That is until the only non-Italian present, a Miss Florence Lewis, lets out a stifled giggle at this superstitious Latin tomfoolery as she sees it. Mr. Scala stares her down and then asks the spirit, "How much money does Mr. Apicella have in his pocket?" The answer comes back via a series of knocks. 4 shillings and 6p. Mr. Apicella reaches into his pocket, places the coins on the table, and counts them. And with that, Miss Lewis stops giggling. As Rasputin recedes back into the depths whence he came, Mr. Scala rises from the table with his finger to his lips and slips a record onto the gramophone player. The Dead March, the only music with which to summon Paganini, the greatest violinist in history, but the man who, it said, owed his skill to a deal with the devil. Impatient, Apicella nudges Scala with his knee. "Chiedi," he whispers, "chiedi a lui. Vinceremo la lotteria irlandese." Scala licks his parched lips and asks the question, "Maestro, will we win the Irish lottery? Maestro, if we have the winning ticket, lift the table twice to let us know." Scala settles back into his chair, clutches the hands of Constantino and Apicella, and then gasps as the table rises above his knees, once, twice, and crashes to the ground. As the shock dissipates, the room dissolves into cheers and laughter. But the laughter won't last long, because Scala does hold the winning ticket. And whether it's the devil's doing or not, that ticket will shortly ruin the lives of everyone present. When Graykill won the National, reporters descended upon the modest Battersea Cafe to congratulate the newly rich Emilio Scala. But if Paganini had guided the hand of the nurse who drew Scala's ticket from the enormous sweepstakes drum, the devil wasn't long in claiming his due. Back in Italy, Scala's elderly mother was informed of her son's good fortune and immediately dropped dead. "She died of happiness," Scala said. Already coping with one family tragedy, Scala almost suffered another. He told reporters that his son had badly injured his back in an accident. What he didn't tell reporters was that his fortune had also attracted the attention of the London Mafia, such as it was, which tried to extort a share of his profits from him. But the black hand of Cosa Nostra wasn't the only hand in Scala's pocket. before he could draw down his winnings, Scala found himself dragged before the High Court of the Irish Free State. The plaintiffs were his former friends Constantino and Apicella, the men who had summoned the spirits with him on that eerie night in Walthamstow. Before a packed gallery at the Four Courts in front of Justice Meredith, lawyers for the two men claimed that Scala had conjured Paganini to persuade them to buy a share in his book of tickets. Scala, for his part, claimed that the winning ticket belonged to him and him alone. It was a surreal couple of days in the High Court as witness after witness came forward to give evidence about the séance, about the spirits of Rasputin and Paganini, about the unearthly rattling and tapping and shaking of tables. Some were more sceptical than others. Signor Vecchioni told the court, "I only saw the faces of people in the room. I didn't see any spirits, except for the whiskey on the sideboard." Most of the witnesses were Italian. Some took the oath with the fascist salute, and almost all of them, according to Justice Meredith, were lying through their teeth. He found that both sides had told blatant lies in the witness box, but that Constantino and Apicella had no legitimate claim to the money. A brand new technique called ultraviolet imaging proved that key evidence had been forged. The money belonged to Scala and to him alone. Then, as now, the court proceedings largely served to make the lawyers richer at everyone else's expense. Scala was now free to claim his £100,000, but 20,000 of that went to George Gavin Duffy KC and his colleagues. If Paganini had wanted to teach everyone a lesson about the cost of making deals with dark forces, then he'd done his job. If there was indeed a curse attached to the ticket, the lottery, and the Grand National that year, then its reach was long. Bob Lyle, the jockey who rode Greycoat to victory in the National, was subsequently paralysed when his horse crashed into a fence at Brocklesby. Mind you, Mr. Scala himself did go on to live out his 70 years in wealth and comfort, but he lost most of his friends in the process. In later years, the Irish people would discover just how much of a curse the hospital sweepstakes had placed on their society. But that's a different story for a different night. Now, the night is falling fast, faster than it usually does at this time of year. But we do have time for a couple more tales before we get back to our starting point. This one doesn't date from some dark, windswept evening in the era of the gas lamp and the horse-drawn coach, but from the height of summer in a much more modern time of fluorescent lighting and cheap plastic tat, otherwise known as the 1980s. Now, for decades, Cleary's department store on O'Connell Street was one of Dublin's most famous landmarks, and in an era of somewhat slower communication, meeting under Cleary's clock was such a well-observed ritual that it became something of a cliché. In mid-June 1986, as the world marvelled at the skills of Diego Maradona under the blazing Mexican sun, a remarkable story appeared in the Dublin newspapers. Whereas most stories of hauntings and apparitions tend to evoke scepticism and titters in the modern world, this encounter was shocking and deadly serious to the worker who brushed up against it. It left her physically sick and unable to work for some time. Cleary's department store has stood on O'Connell Street in one form or another since the 1850s. Well, it stopped standing altogether at one point in 1916 when it was destroyed by fire during the Easter Rising. But it was swiftly rebuilt and the cash registers began to churn and sing once more. At one time, Cleary's shop assistants would have slept in dormitories within the department store itself. Tied to their workplace, perhaps their restless, tethered spirits left some kind of trace on the premises, because by the 1980s, it was common for security guards to hear footsteps echoing through the halls after hours, after dark, only to find nothing stirring in the beam of their flashlights. Some guards even reported catching glimpses of an old man stalking corridors at night. Perhaps founder Michael J. Cleary himself, surveying his former empire from beyond the grave. In June 1986, however, a far more tangible apparition made the headlines of the evening papers. After the store had closed for the evening, a staff member in her late 20s walked into a ground floor storeroom belonging to the Roland Cartier concession. They made shoes, not watches. At the rear of the room, a room she knew to be deserted, she felt something brush past her. Alarmed, she turned to see an elderly lady dressed in dark clothing, which seemed to date from another time. As the panic rose within her, the staff member stammered out the words, "I'm sorry, we're closed." The elderly lady then proceeded to disappear before her eyes. This was no passing fancy, no trick of the light after a long day's work. The woman was so terrified, so shaken by what she had witnessed, that she was taken ill. While General Manager Tom Ray, a prominent figure in Irish retail, insisted that his store was not haunted, the woman's union took the matter far more seriously, as well they should have. Just outside Cleary stands a statue of the great union leader Jim Larkin, and it was the union he founded, the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, that now took up the cause. Shop steward Sean Nolan said that there is probably a scientific answer for it all, but the woman involved is a very stable character. Whatever the answer, scientific or otherwise, the woman's shock was very real, and it would be 3 days before she was well enough to return to work. By then, the tale of the Cleary's ghost had hit the newsstands and had begun to attract all sorts of attention, most notably from the self-described psychic Dermot Nolan, who had dropped in to take the paranormal temperature of the store. Dermot, a member of the Society for Psychical and Spiritual Studies, told the Evening Herald that the store had the vibrations associated with a supernatural visitation, but that he could not say for certain whether the entity was benign or malevolent. The only way to be sure was for him to spend a night in the store and try to make contact with whatever spirits haunted this temple of consumerism. Well, perhaps he did. Perhaps he exorcised the spirit of Cleary's, or perhaps management told him where to go. Thereafter, the tale disappears from the archives. Exorcised or not, today Cleary's itself is something of a ghostly presence in Dublin, largely empty and disused, looming over O'Connell Street rather like the relic of a lost civilization. And who knows what eerie presences lurk within its walls after dark, walking the silent corridors. Now they have the place all to themselves. Fog is lifting a little now. The return trip seems a little smoother, does it not? The nights are beginning to draw in just a little. Soon enough we'll be back to the dark, drizzly evenings where Irish spooks and spectres typically dwell. Here's a tragic one, one that has lain unnoticed in the archives for well over 100 years. You've heard of somnambulism, I'm sure, good old-fashioned sleepwalking. You know, I wonder how many reports of roaming apparitions were inspired by the sight of some unfortunate sleepwalker groping blindly through the night in a ghostly trance. But there can be another side to sleepwalking, a much more dangerous side. The question in this case is whether the subject was under the spell of something far more sinister. Sub-postmistress was a very respectable occupation for a woman in Edwardian Belfast, and the sub-postmistress for Crummock Street Post Office was a widow named Hanora Mullen. She had been in that job for at least 10 years, and stayed on after she was widowed, even though now into her 60s she must have had half an eye on retirement. Well, something certainly caught up with her, because by early 1909, she'd begun to complain of fatigue and insomnia, desperate, crippling insomnia. She couldn't sleep, she'd begun to behave strangely. And suddenly, inexplicably, she'd begun to see ghosts. Now, some of the newspapers that reported on the story omitted that detail, perhaps out of respect for the family. But the fact remained that Mr. William H. Jellett, Hanora's son-in-law, put on record that Hanora had told him she was seeing ghosts. This coincided with a remarkable change in her behavior. Such a dramatic change that she couldn't sleep or hold down her familiar job. She was signed off work by her physician, Dr. Montgomery, and she moved in with her daughter and her son-in-law, a Great Victoria Street dentist. And it was there, in Great Victoria Street, that she began to walk in her sleep. Whatever was keeping Hanora awake, whatever was animating her body even in the depths of sleep, the consequences would be tragic. On the evening of Tuesday, February 16th, 1909, Hanora told her daughter and her son-in-law that she wasn't feeling well, and she retired to bed early, about 7:30 p.m. And there she stayed, sleeping peacefully until in due course her daughter and son-in-law also took to bed, and silence reigned over 118 Great Victoria Street. A silence that was rudely shattered at 2 a.m. when Mrs. Jellett, Hanora's daughter, was awakened by the sound of smashing glass. She quickly roused her husband, perhaps fearing burglars, and the two searched the house. Finding nothing untoward, they made for Hanora's room to see she was all right. Hanora wasn't there. Not in the bed, not in the doorway, not by the dresser. With mounting unease, Mrs. Jellett saw the landing window was open. She walked towards the window, and to her horror, she heard moaning sounds coming from the yard below. With fear burning in her breast, Mrs. Jellett looked down into the yard and saw her mother, Hanora Mullen, lying in a bruised and battered heap amid a pile of broken glass. Dr. Montgomery was sent for immediately, but by the time he arrived, there was nothing he could do but close Hanora's unseeing eyes. The coroner's inquest was unambiguous. Hanora Mullen, widow, Great Victoria Street, Belfast, late of Crummock Street Post Office, had died aged 62 after crashing through a landing window, plunging the 30 feet to the pavement below, and fracturing her skull in the course of an episode of sleepwalking. A woman who reported seeing ghosts, who was so badly affected by whatever disturbing visions she had seen, that she could no longer work, nor sleep, nor control her exhausted body, had smashed through a window in her sleep to her death. Think of that, perhaps, when next you're tempted to wish for an encounter with something supernatural, for the frisson of the paranormal. Not everyone who sees into that other realm lives to tell the tale. Ah, excellent. We're back where we started. Well done, Hilliard. I say Hilliard. Odd. Let's just dash out and check on him. Where's the fellow got to? You'd see him if he'd run off somewhere. You can see for miles around up here. I can't see him, can you? Extraordinary. There go the horses. Same steady trot as though Hilliard were up there. Oh well. Looks like they know where they're going. Here, my friend, is where I must leave you. The city is that way, and do watch your step in the dark. I look forward to seeing you again. I do enjoy these evenings, and needless to say, the only unnatural device I ever use in relating these stories is my old gramophone player. Perhaps we'll meet in Doran's next time and spin a few records to help us along. Here comes the rain. Wasn't forecast, but most bothersome. Careful on that rocky path, my friend, and we shall meet again soon.